The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
There's no culture quite as strange as that of an American antique store. I was recently in such a store with a friend of mine who lives in Germany. This was his first occasion to ever experience such a store. Every so once in a while, I would pick up an item, perhaps a rusty apple peeler or the lesser part of a felt hat, and I would turn it over in my hands and weigh it against the price noted on the neon adhesive tag stuck on the bottom. More often than not, I set it back down again. After about an hour of this, my friend said to me in his broad accent, "If you want to buy some trash, I can sell you some of the things from my garbage can." Despite being mocked, I often return to that antique store. When I walk in the door, I am surrounded by the artifacts of an era gone by. These are the things that men made when they thought differently. They had different practices and manners of conduct, different knowledge and desires. These are the things that compose tradition, and it is the ambition of this speech to defend them. G.K. Chesterton, in his book Orthodoxy, defended tradition with an appeal to our sometimes inane devotion to democracy. My defense is derived from his argument, but before I demonstrate the imperative nature of preserving democracy and tradition, it is necessary to reflect on the danger that the world faces without it. I am sure that for my friend, a member of such a utilitarian society as the Germans, it was confusing to see me coveting these superannuated wares in that antique store. It may be strange for you to hear of an individual of my age that cares for old stuff. Not many teenagers share the taste for 70s folk music that I have, like Alistair Begg. Not many teenagers have a taste for anything from the 70s at all. In fact, my generation has developed a deplorable habit of throwing out that which is old. Certainly didn't start with teenagers of the 21st century finding no taste for shag carpet, and it's not likely to end with them either. Yet, a disdain for that which is old, on no other basis than its age, is only a symptom of a much more insidious epidemic. It is called relativism. In the second act of the namesake play, Hamlet said, "There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." This is as fair of a definition of relativism as any. Such pseudo-philosophies as relativism have been spoiling the world's pursuit of truth since the fall of man. It was chiefly man's belief in his own truth over God's that wrought his condemnation in the book of Genesis. This same desire to disregard absolute principle in favor of one's own prompted Protagoras to famously argue against Socrates, "What's true for me is true for me, and what's true for you is true for you." This sophistry was buried by subsequent centuries of unification through a global church and the celebration of the Renaissance art. However, in the humanist return to early Greek philosophy, some enlightened men of the 1700s violated the philosophical tombs of ancient Europe and resurrected its intellectual horrors. The putrid corpses of their ceremony now prowl the streets of our communities, and any who cross their path are choked to death. The postmodern era of my generation has considered the solipsism of these ruinous ages and attempted to make it their own, yet there's a critical difference between the two. The conceited of 300 years ago crafted their conclusions from a careful and diligent study of the philosophical tradition, whereas we take their affirmations today as license to throw out all the world's history of epistemic journey. For if there is no truth, then why bother with another's advantage, especially that of those who died in epochs past? We have burned the tomes of 1,000 years of meditation at the feet of the idol of subjectivity, all the while chanting, "What's true for me is true for me, and what's true for you is wrong." There's no hope for the clergy of that religion of denial. There's only one thing strong enough to save us from the religion of denial. I will give 3 reasons for why we need tradition. First, because a man is not enough to fight this individualistic syndrome. Second, because the converse of the individual is democracy. And third, because we must have the dead at our councils. First, a man is not enough to fight this individualistic syndrome. There is nothing in our own heads capable of saving us from such misery. The sarcophagus lid is too heavy to fit back into place on our own. This sort of disillusionment cannot be cured from the inside out. It is a tailspin dive, a plummet that self-perpetuates. The more a person believes chiefly and exclusively in his own truth, the more they cast off community. And the more they withdraw from the global conversation, the more inclined they are to trust themselves. Consider a conspiracy theorist. He is marked by belief in his theory over all society's objections. He claims to be privy to a knowledge beyond that of all of his peers. He is not culturally engaged. A man who believes all the world is a computer program and everybody in it is out to kill him is far less likely to live in the suburbs. A cabin in the woods would suit him better. A relativist is a special kind of conspiracy theorist. He believes that this whole world of courts and judicial systems is colluding to convince him that there is such a thing as truth and justice. It is not so much that the relativist viscerally disbelieves in the concrete, but that he wishes not to be constricted by it. This is the man of lawlessness that Paul wrote about in 2 Thessalonians. Quote, he will oppose and exact himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple proclaiming himself to be God. End quote. The problem is that once he's built himself a temple, it is impossible for him to escape by himself. And a temple without a door becomes a mausoleum. I would not expect a single man to overcome his theory of subjectivity any more than I would expect a man to conquer his pride complex while living alone on an island. Donne said, no man is an island. I agree. And the more that a man aspires to be an island, the more he slips into the ocean and ceases to be a man at all. It was Plato who said, every heart sings a song incomplete until another heart whispers back. Second, the condors of the individual is democracy. It is one of the fundamental principles of society that men are more than man, that a collection of islands is less than a continent. A man takes the small step, men take the giant leap. The bane of relativism will be democracy, the institutional recognition that the mind of many is greater than the mind of few, the admission that there is truth outside of self, and it is worth our greatest counsels. Democracy is the assembly of people who wish to invest in and be guarded by a transcendental power. It is the ultimate response to denial of that power. Each man is holding the brick of his intellect. Society is something like a tower in construction. Democracy is the bricklaying company. It is the coordination of minds to construct the greatest edifices of history's horizon. The singular man is disposed to sit at the base of the tower, lean his back up against the wall, and yell to the other workers, there are no bricks and there is no tower. The easiest way to cure him of such a silly idea is to turn him around and put a brick in his hand. Democracy at work. In this way, democracy saves the man from the suicide of becoming an island, and the tower continues to grow. Finally, we must have the dead at our councils. The Congress of the Minds most proximate to ourselves is not adequate. You need more than the people you share the air with. A battalion is hardly better than a single soldier when you are facing legions. When Israel was exiled and trampled and all but choked to death by the resurrection of their own evil sacrilegion, the prophet Ezekiel was taken up in a vision. The Lord promised Ezekiel, I will sprinkle clean water on you, I will cleanse you, and you will be clean from your impurities and all your idols. How could Israel be saved from the desolation of their exile? The Lord took the prophet to a valley of dry bones, the remains of the ancestors of God's chosen people. The Lord said to Ezekiel, prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. My people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from them. Israel did return from exile and to the faith of their fathers. Tradition is the recognition that the army is not nearly as small as some would have it. Tradition is the breath of life into an army of dry bones. Chesterton called it giving votes to the most obscure of all classes, our ancestors. It is the democracy of the dead. Tradition refuses to submit to the small and arrogant oligarchy of those who merely happen to be walking about. Chesterton reminds us of the greatest parliament in existence, one that we have either forgotten or spited. The diet of all human existence. It has been called the great conversation. It has been called philosophy. It is tradition. Despite our nescient devotion to the century into which we were born, it is not limited to the contemporary generation, or all generations since the Enlightenment, or even all generations since the Bronze Age, but belongs to every man who has ever lived and had a thought. You are a representative with a vested power to change the world in a manner that a dead man cannot. We hold a sort of office and authority. To forget your constituents simply because they are not alive is despotism. Tradition is the due and proper process of honoring the dead and their wish for the world, and your consequent salvation from your own desolation on the island of relativism. Yet, there are some who, not without personal cause, deny the relevance of tradition. They plainly argue that men in the past have been wrong, and they perhaps speak with the words of Yidu Krishnamurti when he said, "Tradition, long-conditioned thinking, can bring about a fixation, a concept that one readily accepts, perhaps not with a great deal of thought." This is a toxic form of discrimination. The American Declaration of Independence proudly states that all men are created equal. If it were true that they were only equal as long as they were living, then we would have no cause to honor the Declaration, the synthesis of a party now 6 feet under. Chesterton wrote, "Those who urge against tradition that men in the past were ignorant may go and urge it at the Carlton Club, along with the statement that voters in the slums are ignorant." To discredit the vote of a man because he is dead is as undemocratic as the same action against a woman on account of her sex or a Christian on account of his faith. Certainly, I agree there is a danger in tradition. The tradition of Western civilization was slavery. The tradition of Caribbean tribesmen was cannibalism. The tradition of man is sin. Certainly, an uncritical acceptance of the methods of antiquity is evil, but I argue entirely for the opposite. Not just critical acceptance, but critical implementation. The disciples of Krishnamurti's misbranded New Age revelation would have you throw out billions of learned men with the bathwater. I would have you strain it first. This is why I'm able to curse the proclivities of the ancient Greeks, a member of a philosophical tradition all their own, and in the same breath stress the importance of history and its lessons. To argue for the truth of everything that has ever been said is folly. To argue for its utility is fair. A definitive indication of our inability to learn is our modern understanding of progress. It is an idol, same as subjectivity. We worship this construct of human conceit. We beg morality of it, but all we truly want is justification. We claim we want to move the world forward, but all we accomplish is the license to forget the world as long as we are moving. The relativist contention is that life is something like a brick road. You need not look back. The only importance of the bricks behind you is that they were. However, life is like that tower in construction. And when you stand at the top of that tower, you are quite glad that every brick still is. How then are we to give proper regard to tradition in the affairs of today? Books are the palpable vessel of tradition. They are the documentation of how our ancestors thought and acted. It is a measure of their philosophy. Every man has a clear and unapologetic understanding of the world, and thereby a wish for how it should be dealt with by those who possess the power to change it. Some of them were explicit in stating their creed. They are the ones who wrote those academic tomes which we so shamefully burned and are at present no more effectual than the pile of ashes. However, even if the book did not have the word philosophy in the title, the writings are pregnant with the author's worldview. The study of historical writings is a seance with Caesar's, Napoleon's, and Lincoln's. If he wrote a book, he cast his vote. Our responsibility is to read those books. There is a pragmatic benefit to my cause, one that even pagan cultures have survived by for centuries. But as Christians, we must take special care to love tradition. Our God is a God who reveals himself in history. He told Moses that he is the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is constant, and so are the failures of man. As the 106th Psalm says, we have sinned even as our ancestors did. The God of our fathers is faithful to redeem the sins of our sons. Tradition is the refinement of humanity, the slow shaping of God's people into the image of Christ. My mother is principally the reason for my trips to those antique stores. She is the one who introduced me to the joys of buying old things. Even though she may not have approved of the apple peeler I bought, this is one of the most treasured traditions I have from my mother. But the most meaningful is my faith. I met my faith through the faith of my parents and a trust in their wisdom. The church, the tradition of a relationship with God, is the greatest treasure humanity has. Paul wrote in Thessalonians the key to not becoming that man of lawlessness. Therefore, brothers, hold fast to the traditions that you have been taught, whether by word or by letter. This is the promise of tradition, the endurance of truth, and the assurance of a relationship with God. Thank you.
Thank you so much.